The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Inspirational women are increasingly popular in the news and media, but many go unheard and their stories are never told. Women to Watch with Susan Rocco captures the stories of many women who truly make a difference. Women to Watch is the vehicle for developing new leaders, encouraging younger generations, and in building self-esteem for future entrepreneurs.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch here on WWDB Talk 860. My name is Sue Rocco, and I want to give a couple quick show notes before we get started. One is if you would like to join the conversation and call into the show, we would love to hear from you. You can do that by dialing 888-329-3306. And also, please check out our website at womentowatch.net. That's women, the number two, watch.net for all our show updates. I'd like to give a thank you to Holy Redeemer Health System, as always, for being one of our core sponsors. And I'd also like to make an announcement that we will be bringing on a new sponsor to the show. Her name is Jocelyn Ewert, and Jocelyn is the founding principal of Entrust Financial, and she will be an ongoing contributor to the show as well. So I want to say thank you to Jocelyn. I am very happy to have a guest with me in the studio this afternoon, and also our weekly contributor, Dr. Beth Dupree, who's joining us from the hospital, just fresh out of the OR. Our guest this afternoon will be Beth Weinstock, and Beth is a psychologist and principal at the Resiliency Group here in Philadelphia, and her work focuses on her private practice as well as leadership consultancy with a focus on women in particular. So I'm real excited to have her with us today, and we have a lot to talk about. But I want to welcome Beth to the show. She's joining us from our hospital studio.
Which Beth? This Beth.
Yes,
oh,
Dr. Beth
so
Dupree.
Today. Oh, my God. What a day. How are you guys doing down there?
We're doing great. I'm looking out the window, and it's looking not so pretty as it was last week, but that's okay.
It was awfully chilling cold, like the wet cold, which I don't like. I don't mind dry cold. I can handle all of that, but the wet cold is awful.
It is awful.
Awful, awful, awful.
Only a couple days of it, and then we're going to get a beautiful rest of the week.
I know, and I ate too much turkey over the weekend, I think. But it was a wonderful holiday. My boys were home. Were you with your kids?
Oh, yes, we were. My children were home, and we had 35 for Thanksgiving at my sister-in-law's. You know, the big family we have.
I had four. I had four, which was wonderful, which is like the least I've ever, ever had in my entire life.
That sounds really wonderful and relaxing and calm.
It was amazing, and we kind of hung out. Tommy only came home for 2.5 days, which was fabulous, but it's just nice to have your family together and kind of hang out, and we went go-karting at Speed Raceway in Horsham, and I got to see my son's go-karting skills, which was kind of funny because, you know, all those years of college and that expense and what you have to show for it is your kid finishes as the ninth fastest time at that raceway, and he's never been there before. And so I was like, that is something to be really proud of, you know, as the mom racer that I am. So,
do you worry at all, or do you just cheer him on?
No, I was racing with him. I was driving a car at the same time. Are you kidding?
I'm impressed.
It's something I want to take some of my management team there, because you can really build great team relationships through stuff like that, because, you know, it's not, I mean, the cars are, they're electric go-karts, they're fast, but it's not like you're out on a racetrack in bad conditions. You're in helmets, you're in great little cars, but the cool thing is that it's about teamwork and learning. You know, you have to follow the rules. If they flag you that you're going slow, you've got to move over and let the other guy pass, and there's a lot to learn. I mean, it's a really good team building experience, so I'm going to be interested in getting Beth's take on that, because it's on my bucket list, because this raceway place has a phenomenal a business meeting place, and I'm like, what more fun place to try to build a team than taking them outside the health system and doing something fun? So it's on my bucket list for the near future, for the first quarter of 2016. So
that's great. Have you shared that news with them? Because now you're going to have to do it.
Well, they're going to hear it. Hopefully they're listening. I think my staff is still, most of my staff is still in the operating room, but this is going to be some of my male physician leaders, because it's a whole new relationship I have. I told you, you know, now that I'm in my new role in the health system, I have a lot of men that I work with and that now report to me, so to speak, and to try to, you know, really build these strong relationships. I think, you know, and racing is kind of, it's much more of a guy sport than women. There are way more male racers than there are women, mm-hmm. but I think it's a great way to kind of break that ice. So I'll be interested to get Beth's take on that then. But listen, before we forget, tomorrow night, December 1st,
yes.
I think you remember when I came back from the Integrative Medicine Conference, I was raving and ranting about this phenomenal naturopath, Dr. Lise Alschuler. I am going to be a guest on her show called Five to Thrive with Lise Alschuler and Carolyn Gazella, and it's tomorrow night. I've tweeted out the information. It starts at live at 7 o'clock, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk about the topic that I call the cliff, or what happens after cancer treatment's completed. And it's a really, really important topic, because it's something that a lot of people don't understand, particularly family members. They think that if someone's done their cancer treatment that life is ducky and you go back to where you were, but the life that you had before that cancer diagnosis doesn't exist anymore. So it's a really, really important topic, and particularly before the holidays, because the holidays are an uber stressful time for everybody anyway. And so to be able to attack this, you know, topic right before the holidays, I think it's going to be pretty good. So,
where can we pick up the show, Beth?
Well, the show is actually on W4CS.com. Again, W4CS.com, which is it's called Five to Thrive. You can Google it, called Five to Thrive. But their show, it goes via the Internet. I'm going to be doing it via Skype from my house.
Oh, great.
With a cup of tea in my hand and my fuzzy slippers on, which
very
I love
nice.
That. I love that we get to do that, even though I'm kind of in my pajamas here at the hospital, my scrubs. But
that sounds
anyway,
great.
Otherwise, everything is good. The practice is thriving. We're very busy. And I am excited to hear from Beth, because I was checking her out online, and she's done some very cool things. And I actually want to get all of her wisdom, because now that I'm in a new leadership position in the health system, I think she's someone that can give me a lot of very good information. And also, sitting next to me is my breast fellow, who's actually, you know, you understand fellowships. We talked about this before. A breast fellow is a surgeon who's already a board-certified surgeon who's in a year of specialty training. And so Liza Thalheimer is my breast fellow from Bryn Mawr. I have to send her back to Bryn Mawr tomorrow because her month is up with us. So I'm sending her back in your direction. But she's hanging out with me here, and she's on hold for the show. So she might have some interesting questions, because I think Beth King probably gives some very good advice to young physicians who are just about to begin a new career path, going from like the student to the expert. So
terrific.
It's all good.
Terrific. Okay, that sounds great. So let's introduce our guest for today. As I mentioned, her name again is Beth Weinstock, and Beth is a psychologist, and she is the principal at the Resiliency Group here in Philadelphia. And her work focuses on private practice, but also very much involved in leadership coaching, and in particular women, which is why we're so thrilled to have her here this afternoon. Welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Sue.
We met, you and I met a long time ago, probably
right.
over a year ago. It's
That's
you know,
right.
And we finally got you here in the studio, and I'm really grateful, because I know how busy you are.
I'm delighted to be here. Yes. We met a year ago when I was on a panel, and I remember that you asked a very good question towards the end of the panel discussion, and then we had a conversation after that, you and I.
Yeah. See, yeah. It pays to speak up and raise your hand.
It pays to speak up. That's probably the title of this conversation.
Yeah. Terrific. And as you know, we always like to give a nice backstory of our guests so that the listeners can get a real sense of who you are and what led to your work. So I understand that you were born and raised in a town called Greenwich, New York City. Is that correct?
I was born and raised in Greenwich Village, New York City.
Oh, it is
City.
Greenwich Village.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
The bio said
yeah.
Greenwich, and I thought
That's a spelling error.
That's a spelling error. I thought, I'm not familiar with Greenwich,
no,
but Greenwich.
That's funny.
Okay.
No.
Very cool hip town.
It was a very cool hip town, yes. And I grew up in a cool hip family in many ways. I was privileged in many ways, and not necessarily financially, but I grew up with art and music and expectation of my being creative and the room for me to be creative. And in terms of gender expectations, there were no divides in my family. My mother worked, my father worked, and there was the assumption that I would do whatever it is that led my, that was my passion.
Yeah, and I know you and I talked off air about, you know, one of the challenges you faced as a young girl was struggling with reading, which if people read your bio now and your profile, they might be surprised at that because you're so strong academically. And talk about what that did for you, your self-esteem as a young girl, as particularly in the family that you grew up.
Yeah, well, it was not easy in my family having a hard time learning how to read. Books were everywhere. My parents read all the time. And I had a hard time learning how to decipher letters and words. I was in a private school where I was the kid pulled out of the class to have remedial reading. Mm. So on the one hand, while I was encouraged and supported in so many ways, on the other hand, I grew up feeling like there's something I'm not doing right.
Yeah.
There's some part of me that's not smart enough. There's something wrong with my brain. And I felt that in comparison to the other students in my class who seemed to have no trouble at all learning how to read, our early readers.
Yeah.
So it did set me up for feeling that I'm just not smart enough.
Mm.
And when you have that kind of feeling when you're young, it's very hard to compensate for. It's hard to learn to get past.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of the things that had me very sensitive to other people having trouble with something, struggling with something.
Mm-hmm.
I think I became very attentive to the folks who were not having an easy time about one thing or another. And I do think it contributed very much to my sense of compassion for people who are managing not feeling as good as someone else.
Yeah. Let me ask you, when was it recognized? Because I think obviously when we're young and we're struggling with something and it goes unnoticed, or, you know, we don't speak up and tell a parent, a teacher, a friend about it, then it gets worse. So when was this this struggle that you were having in reading recognized? At what age, and then how did it manifest itself?
Well, it was recognized when I was 7, which is when the remedial reading started. So I still have memories of being 7 years old, being pulled out of class, the one kid pulled out for the special attention. So the attention to it started early, and then there was a lot of hard work that I put into being able to do the work. I have always done very well in school, and it always took me, I think, longer than some, certainly not longer than everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always known that to do well was going to take a lot of attention on my part, particularly when reading and writing was the task. And I've done a lot of reading and writing.
You have. You have. And I find it so interesting that that would have been your particular struggle as a young girl.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you did go on to receive a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a doctorate in psychoeducational processes, which
That's
I'll
right.
let you explain.
Yeah.
Exactly what
yeah.
that is.
Yeah.
So I do want to know, what was the motivating factor behind your academic drive, and did it directly connect to those struggles as a young girl?
It's a great question. I don't really know how to connect the dots quite so clearly. I never had a big academic drive. I was just kind of curious about things and wanted to learn, and got satisfaction out of learning. So, in fact, I went into the wrong field first off. I thought I wanted to be an American historian and went to graduate school in American history. Columbia University was not very happy with me, and I was not very happy with them in that process. It was really a mismatch. And it took me a long time to find out that what I really wanted to do was what I'm doing.
Yeah. And what... Go ahead, Beth.
I have a quick question about your childhood. Do you think that if you were a child today, that you would have had a label, so to speak, because of your struggles with reading? Do you think you would have been labeled or medicated or something? Because I'm always concerned. I mean, I know that there were kids that I was really good at reading comprehension, but I was very slow at the actual being able to read the pages. And I know that now we have kids that are that do struggle in school, but they tend to get a label of different letters and then are kind of, I don't want to say ostracized, but they end up having, you know, almost that stigma for life. And do you know if you were having your issues today, if you would have been labeled with anything? Or,
you know, Beth, it's an interesting question, because the flip side of what you're saying is that today we actually have such good diagnostics that we can determine much more clearly than when I was young what is the problem. You know, in my day, there was just this global difficulty in learning how to read. But I think today, with the very good assessments that we have, kids can, while on the one hand maybe get a label and that may not be good, on the other hand get help at the very specific
Correct.
Area that they're having difficulty in. And so many of even our public schools now have very well-trained people who can help a wide range of young students who are having learning differences.
Yeah, because I know that my youngest son had, he was a slow reader. He was young for his age in school, and reading was really a challenge. And after he worked with a reading specialist for about a year and a half, it was like the light bulb turned in. And
yeah.
It wasn't like there was something was missing. It was like one day, suddenly it all made sense.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm glad that happened for him. And I think that, again, we have found really good ways to attend to specific learning differences.
I think we don't all learn the same way.
We don't.
Some people are right-brained,
some people are
very left-brained.
That's
and
right.
And that's, you know, traditionally schools were made for children that are able to learn via left brain type processes. So
yes.
I was just curious, but I think it's fascinating that was your path.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're doing such amazing things in trying to solve all these other communication issues and relationship issues. So anyway, it's all good. So back to the story. Sorry, Sue.
Okay.
Thanks for the question.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank
no.
You,
great.
Beth.
Great question. I think it's true that the positive of today's world is that we do have these diagnostics so that we can really get to the root of it. Where back, you know, when I think about our years growing up,
yeah.
Things went unnoticed and untalked.
Yeah,
you
kids
know.
Weren't even diagnosed with dyslexia back then.
They weren't.
That's right.
And that was hard. Mm-hmm.
And it's such a treatable. It's so kids are brilliant. With dyslexia, they just can't learn the same way, and if
That's
they're
right.
not identified,
mm-hmm.
then they don't survive in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then that will add to the anxiety.
That's right.
And
That's
the insecurity.
Right.
So, one of the things I wanted to mention, and I want the audience to know, is that you write for the Huffington Post.
I do.
And you write some great pieces. And I read your post about not letting times of change and uncertainty hijack our self-confidence.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, struck a chord with me because you and I, again, have talked, you know, outside of the studio about this fear that we sadly have to live with in today's world that we did not years ago. And that speaks to the inner coach, which is very much about the work that you do, helping both men and women have an inner coach as opposed to this inner critic that continually gets in the way. And you stated that the inner coach has a positive-oriented thought pattern that differs from the inner critic. So talk for a few minutes about the inner critic that we all have, what it does, and some of the ways that we can turn that around to be a coach that helps us deal with negativity, fear, and all of the other, you know, chatter.
Well, I think that many of us have an inner voice that says things like, I'm just not smart enough, or I'm not good enough at this, or I'm not pretty enough. For women, it's often I'm not thin enough, or I'm not, for men, it's not I'm buff enough, or I'm not going to be able to get that project done because nobody will ever believe in what I have to say. There are many different ways that an inner critic speaks to us. Sometimes it's about worry. There's the worry that, well, what if I go for that job interview and I don't get it? What if they don't like what I have to say? What if that group doesn't invite me back after I've been there the first time? There are multiple ways that we have kind of fear and negativity, worrying, and self-criticism. Some of us hear it in the form of, I'm so stupid. Some of it hear it as a voice that says, you're just not good enough. And not everyone has the same degree of negative self-talk. But when we have negative self-talk, it's really important to be able to hear it and identify it. Because one of the things that happens that's so insidious is that if we have a strong negative self-talk, this negative inner voice, it can be so frequent in our mind that we don't even begin to hear it anymore. And in order to reverse it, in order to counteract it, we have to get clear about what it is that we're saying to ourselves. Once we can hear what we're saying, we can develop the voice of an inner coach. My work partner and I, Dr. Jane Schuer at the Resilience Group, we call this creating an inner coach stronger than the inner critic. Once we can hear the negativity, we can say, oops, I just heard it. Stop. Is there another way to think that thought? Is there another prediction that I could make about that? Once I hear myself saying, oh, they'll never like my proposal, I can go, wait a minute. Why did I say that to myself? I can stop that thought and say, well, there's the possibility that they're going to accept my proposal. And we can begin to shift the patterning. The negative is patterned. For some of us, certainly for myself, it comes from childhood. And those patterns from childhood are very embedded in our brain. Beth, you know much about this in terms of brain patterns. But we can create new brain patterns. And in the last 20 years, there's been so much phenomenal research on the brain and on neural networking and how we can create new pathways, literal pathways in the brain towards more positive self-talk, more positive affirmation of the self, towards positive future thoughts. But it takes practice.
Mm. And I guess a lot of
neuroplasticity.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of work to determine where these negative thoughts originated from. Isn't that equally as important to being able to kind of train them and manage
them? It's certainly a very important part. So, yes, it's important to know. If I came from parents that were particularly critical, it's like, oh, yes, I've internalized their voice. I'm being critical because that's what I heard growing up. Or if we've had experiences in which we have not been successful in one way or the other, we may have that voice very profoundly. So, yes, it's important to know where the negative pattern came from. But equally and even maybe more important is to recognize the negative pattern and choose to interrupt it and practice a new way of speaking to ourselves. You know, I'm as a psychologist, I'm a believer absolutely that it's important to know where our issues come from. But if we only know where they come from and don't do anything differently about it, we may not change. And right. The fabulous new info from neuroplasticity, thank you, Beth, for mentioning that wonderful word, is that we can shift the patterns if we pay attention. You know, I'm an adult learner of taking the piano. So I'm 1 year into practicing new patterns with my fingers. And it's mind-blowing how hard it is. But it's also amazing that if you practice, things change. Things shift. So I'm playing things now I wasn't able to play a year ago. And I've learned to say things to myself in my mind differently than the way I would have said them to myself 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more self-support and self-encouragement in my own self-talk than there used to be. So since I know I've changed with practicing, I know other people can change with practicing. And that's the work that my partner and I, Jane Schuer and I, do when we work with groups of people, is helping them get clear about the negative mind messages, how we can interrupt them, and what the practice looks like, and then doing that with them.
I tell my patients all the time that their thought forms and beliefs, what they say, what they think, dictates a lot of times how our immune system responds as well. And, you know, if you identify yourself as a cancer victim or as a cancer patient instead of someone who may have had cancer who's now healthy, whole, and complete and healed, it's a very different mindset.
Yes. Yes. We need to be attentive as well to those belief systems that we have about ourselves. You know, if we believe that we're only going to fail, and Beth, you're saying if you believe that you're only the victim of an illness, if that's the belief system, it will determine a lot of how you feel about yourself and how you see yourself in the future. So a lot of the work is also about getting clear about what have I been believing about myself, and is it accurate? And do I need to challenge this negative belief that I've had?
And would you say that we are continually, if as you mentioned, you've come to some realizations of your own later in life, that we are always continually getting better with this positive mindset over a negative? In other words, we won't get to a place where we've fixed it, is my guess. Is that true?
I think we can get to a place where we're no longer hurting ourselves with negative assumptions and negative forecasting about what's going to happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we ever fix ourselves. In fact, I think that a lot of what we need to do is be compassionate with ourselves about the things that are not going to be fixed.
Yeah.
You know, none of us is perfect. We're not going to be. And actually, that's one of the things about dealing with negative self-belief is too many people think that if I fix me and keep fixing me, I'm going to wind up being some kind of perfect self, which mm-hmm. is not going to happen.
Right, right. And would you say there's, you know, there, as you mentioned early in the show, people have different levels, right,
yes.
of their negative talk. And I would imagine that's based on their experience, their personal life
yes.
experience. Do you see any differences when you are working with clients, patients, men versus women, in their ability to accept your recommendations, you know, the work that you want them to do? Is there pushback maybe more from one or the other gender?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, Sue. I actually don't experience any more resistance or pushback from men. I think that women are quicker to know that they have negative self-talk going on. When I meet women and I say, what I do is I help women create an inner coach stronger than their inner critic, they smile. They go, oh, yeah, I need that.
That sounds great.
And I say, I need that, too.
Sign me up.
Yeah,
right.
Sign
we
me
all
up.
Need that. Right.
Yeah. I think fewer men resonate to it, though I don't know that they have any less an inner critical message system. It sits differently, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they are less apt to be talking about it mm-hmm. with each other. One of the great things about women, I think, in my experience, is our willingness to share what some of these struggles are. And I think that men, by and large, have a harder time sharing what's in their own way.
Yeah. And that, gosh, that's a whole other topic, isn't it? Why?
That's because they're in their cave most of the time.
Their cave.
Where they're safe with their emotions in their cave.
Right, right. Well, I think the three of us probably have experienced, you know, just men not being as willing to discuss these types of topics because it might point to something that needs fixing. Women are more apt to want to try to fix problems and want to be better, and men seem to want to just kind of go out and do their job every day and not really, and again, I'm totally generalizing, but not talk about feelings and, you know, emotions.
I think as a generalization that, you know, that's true. Interesting, lately in my practice, I have a number of men who are just so eager to be learning and to
that's
be
great.
Taking recommendations and to expand their lives. So I think the generalization's accurate, but it's certainly not accurate all the time because it's just been thrilling to work with the men that I've been working with lately.
Yeah, that's great
yeah.
to hear.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break for our sponsor. When we come back, I want to talk about your Women's Leadership Works.
Great.
And the leadership work you're doing with both men and women. We will be right back.
There are 365 days to schedule a mammogram. Today is as good as any. Holy Redeemer Breast Care makes it easy. We offer the latest technology, like 3D mammography and automated breast ultrasound that help find cancers in dense breast tissue. Plus, our same-day readings mean same-day peace of mind. Make today the day you schedule a mammogram. It's easy to request an appointment online at holyredeemer.com/mammogram.
Welcome back, everyone, to this week of Women to Watch here on WWDB, Talk 860, and womentowatch.net. We are joined this afternoon by Beth Weinstock, psychologist and principal at the Resilience Group here in Philadelphia. And before the break, we were talking about, you know, differences between men and women and feelings and emotions and all that stuff that they don't want to face. But Beth mentioned that she's actually having some real positive feedback from the male clients.
And
I love to hear that because, as you know, Women to Watch is really about encouraging more female leadership, and we certainly need men on board in order to see that. One of the things that you're doing that I think is going to have a very strategic result is this Women's Leadership Works, which you founded. So tell the listeners a little bit about that and what you do with both women and young girls.
What we do in our work is bringing awareness around where is it that I shoot myself in the foot? Where do I get in my own way, and what can I do about it? And what are the themes for young women particularly that get in the way? And we know those themes. We know that that inner critic creates a sense of I'm not entitled to negotiate a salary. I'm not entitled to speak up at the board meeting. I'm an imposter. They're going to find me out. Everybody thinks I'm smarter than I really am. So many women, and perhaps Sue, you've run into this, end sentences with a question mark. You know, the end of the sentence goes right up.
Yes.
Because I'm just not quite sure of what it is that I'm saying. And that sometimes kills my sense of competency as it's received by other people. So a lot of what we do is bring awareness or ask women in our own audiences, what are the ways in which they know this to be true? And what can they individually be doing to counteract these themes where we get in our own way, and what can they be doing in their own workplaces? So some of the time we'll be asking people, what is it that goes on in your workplace that you know is positive towards supporting women having their voice heard and women in leadership, and have that be shared so that people can learn from one another. There certainly are some very good things going on in different organizations that are supporting women's leadership.
Yes.
And then again, we work on how are you going to develop your own inner coach to be stronger than your inner critic? Where are you individually needing to track for yourself where you hear your negativity and shift it around? And that's work that we do in groups. We've done it with many young college women's groups, which is great, getting young women before they go out into the work world full time to be aware of these themes so that they can be prepared when they walk into the workplace and not shoot themselves in the foot.
Right. You know, I think that's so critical, getting to you know, we say women, we're talking about women,
young women.
But if we can begin to give the right messaging to young girls,
that's,
you know,
right,
way before, I think we're going to see a big change.
That's right. And interestingly, and the good news is that there are many college campuses that are bringing in programs like ours to be supporting women so that there are more women leaders once people are getting out of college. So, Beth, I'm interested in your experience with the young female docs, because I think that they're really up against a lot of these issues in traditional medicine.
Well, I'm very fortunate because I get to train many different young physicians every year, and I will say the majority that come through our practice are women, because most of the surgeons going into surgical breast oncology are women. And what's interesting is seeing the kind of the transition from residency is kind of a I don't call it a safe haven, but it's 5 years of this practice of you're on this treadmill going through residency where every day is like really survivor. You're just trying to survive. And when we get them in their year after their residency, in their year of learning how to be, you know, a skilled breast cancer expert, they're kind of transitioning into this whole new place where they don't have to be as potentially as one of the guys as they were in residency. They get to start feeling who they are in their soul again. They get to start bringing aspects of healing back into the healthcare, and it's not just about, you know, doing the cases and doing the surgeries. It's really about learning how to care for the patients. And it's also, I love it because I get to mentor them on other aspects than not just surgery and the biopsies, but actually about life, about, you know, what to expect out of their practice, what to ask for out of their practice, and also, you know, what to look for in relationships. Because a lot of the fellows that I get, they're not married yet. They're trying to figure out this whole, you know, work-life balance, this whole juggling thing. And so that aspect of mentorship, I think, has been wonderful. And I have young breast surgeons all around the country who, you know, at a moment's notice, they'll text me a question, they'll shoot me a call. And Liza's sitting over here this whole hour right now. She's, like, smirking from ear to ear because I can tell every time you say something that resonates with her, it's like she's going, oh, my God, there she's got me. My inner, yes, I'm this good. And then you have a bad case or you can't find the sentinel node and you think, oh, my God, I'm going to be in practice by myself and this is going to be just me. And it's really about we're problem solvers. Surgeons are problem solvers. And so for these young surgeons, being able to help them to build the self-esteem, to be able to go out and practice and do what they do really well, which is, number one, we're healers. We're all healers helping women and men on this journey with cancer. And number two, we're all very skilled surgeons. And, you know, some of us, I've been doing this 27 years, and if I can't do something and make it look easy, I shouldn't be doing it. You know, 25, 26 years experience. And so it can be frustrating, but it's also, like today, you know, Liza got to learn little nuances. She's probably done a million infusion ports in her life, but watching me, like watching a technique that she can take those pearls away, like to me, that is the greatest gift. That's why I love training these young surgeons, because I didn't have that. I left surgical residency, came out in private practice, and I did not get that gift of having that kind of that bridge and that mentor. And so I think, you know, and like Sue does, Sue is a mentor for a lot of other young women going into the communications, and where we can give that gift of our, you know, our personal experience and say, listen, I was there. I felt the same way. Validating those feelings of insecurity. Yep. And mm-hmm. the, oh my God, July 1st, like people are going to come in and suddenly I'm the expert. And so I think that it's neat because we're at a different place in healthcare now than when I finished 25 years ago. There's no longer this mystique that you have to just go and you know, cut your teeth yourself. Like, we really want our young surgeons to come out and feel confident. And if they have questions, it's okay to call and ask. It's great to ask for help if you're in the operating room and you don't have to be the world's expert on day number one. You just have to be competent, and you have to know your limitations. And we're not going to finish somebody in a fellowship if they're not going to be, you know, skilled enough to go out. So I'm trying to get Liza a job with one of my former residents down in Washington. Nancy Marcus is a great breast surgeon in Washington, and she's looking for a partner. So I told her, I said, I'm going to hook Liza up with her, because I would not send somebody to a friend of mine that I wouldn't hire myself.
Does Liza have a question for Beth?
She's actually on the phone. You can get her on the phone because Beth Weinstock, I'm saying that you, Beth Weinstock, so you know that it's not Susan talking to you. But Liza is, can they turn her on so she's actually live?
Well, you know what she can do? She can call the list. She can call the.
She's on it.
Oh, she's on.
She's on.
Okay.
I'm here.
Hey, there she is, Liza.
Hi, Liza.
Hi.
Hi.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So great to have you. And, feel free to speak directly to Beth and ask her some questions.
All right. Well, what she was saying, you know, that was really resonating with me is just, you know, that inner self-doubt that you have. I think that's so important to talk to young women about. I think especially being a female in general surgery, where I trained, it was mostly men. So it's been pretty nice to be out here with Dr. Dupree's group.
I'll bet,
you know,
yeah.
All women. I mean, she's been a great mentor, so I'll be sad when my month is over today.
Liza, can I interrupt for 1 second? Can you turn your radio down or off? Because we're getting an echo.
You know what? It's got to be my microphone.
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, you certainly have a gift in working with Beth, and hopefully then when you are in the position to mentor other people, you're going to be giving the same gift, and it changes the culture, I think, wherever we are when we experience someone who is such a nurturing, excited, and enthusiastic helper in the process of your own development. I've been gifted in having that in my career, and you're being gifted this month. I hope next month is gentle for you when you don't have Beth around.
That will be the test, right?
Yes.
But you I'm lucky. I'm at Bryn Mawr the rest of the year, so I also have great mentors there as
great.
Well. It's nice to be with women for a change.
Yeah, I'll bet. And you know what we're really doing, we're beginning to talk about women supporting other women and validating the fears and the worries and the, am I ever going to make it and am I going to be good enough? And to hear from our teachers and our mentors, of course you're going to be good enough. That's part of the process is doubting sometimes, but you're going to get there, and to be pointing out all the positive things. Because one of the things when we're serious about being competent is we tend to get glued to negative criticism so that we can get better, so that we can fix ourselves and become more and more competent, as if the only important feedback is the negative feedback. I certainly have been there myself. It's like, well, tell me what else I can do well. Tell me what else I could fix. Tell me what else. What, at the end of the interview, I'll probably ask Sue what I could have done better at the interview, you know. And I think we need to all get better at knowing what we do well, at being able to present our strengths, to believe in them, and to take in compliments that we get, to take in the accolades that come our way, rather than only look at the what have I not done well enough at that I can get better at. I think in some regards that's a human thing, but I think women tend to do that more than men. And we need to get better at having Velcro for all the good feedback, not just Velcro for the commentary about how we can be doing something better than we are.
Mm. One of the things, I have a question for you, and Liza, you can stay on because I want to know if this pertains to you as a young woman, excuse me, in your field. And that is, we're surrounded so often and now today more than ever with experts in all fields.
Yeah.
So if we're constantly being fed messaging on how to look perfect, how to work perfect, how to be the perfect mother, all of those things, you know, then it's hard to not be out every day trying to do everything so perfectly. So how do we fight against that and allow ourselves? I love that when you mentioned validating our fears and our insecurities, and I'm sure Liza feels better when she understands that her peers and her colleagues have those same fears. But how do we, in a world where we're being told how to do everything so perfectly, still have that positive mindset?
Well, I think we have to share our failures more often with one another. You know, the things that don't go well. And that's part of why I said Columbia didn't like me and I didn't like Columbia. You know, I didn't do well in a graduate program that I was not well suited for. I can call that a failure. At the time, it felt like a terrible failure. But the fact is, it was all wrong for me.
It wasn't a good fit.
It wasn't a good. Well, it felt like a failure, and it wasn't a good fit. You're exactly right. So I think we need to share those things. I think we need, you know, a couple of years ago, the Harvard Business Review had an entire journal committed to failure. Failure was the big word on the front of the cover of the Harvard Business Review. And increasingly, business people are talking with each other about the things that didn't go right, what they learned from it, mm-hmm. and moving on to their next success. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we share what hasn't worked, we learn a lot, in addition to then what we can put into our next efforts and believe that simply because one thing didn't work, another thing might. And that's part of the positivity thing, that if we can have more of a positive mindset about who we are and what our strengths are, we can also accept the things that we're not good at. We can accept the things that don't fit for us and opt for the things that do.
Yeah. I'm hoping that Liza, speaking about mentorship, receives these kind of messages from doctors like Dr. Dupree, where she is not kind of out there all alone, you know, putting the pressure on herself, which I think a lot of young people do today. It doesn't always come from, you know, the people that are raising them or family. It often comes from within, the pressure to do everything so well.
Yes. Yeah. And perfectionism is, you know, the enemy of the good.
Mm.
And I think we all need to pay attention to when we're being perfectionistic. I try, because I know I have that tendency. But we spend too much time sometimes trying to make things perfect rather than letting good be good enough and move on to the next task.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, perfect gets you in trouble, because the enemy of good is better. And it's unfortunate that we live in a society where the expectation is perfection, because perfection is really not an expectation that any of us can have, you know, all day, every day. You know, sometimes we do things and they're exceptional, but perfection is a word that can get you really into a bad place.
That is true. Mm-hmm.
One of the topics I wanted to make sure we got to today is the trauma recovery. You deal with patients and clients who have experienced trauma, and I think that it's very prevalent. And I'm wondering, you know, this is just a radio show. It's it's not you working in your office, but if you might be able to talk about some of the tools or practices that people who have gone through or are going through some type of trauma, do you use and would be helpful for them?
Great. Yeah. Well, in my private practice, I do work with a lot of people who've experienced different kinds of trauma, from abuse to the trauma of a car accident or the trauma of a sudden loss of a loved person. It's really important, and Beth, I hope you'll chime in with this, that we pay attention to our nervous system, because trauma is really about the body, mind body's inability to manage overwhelming circumstances. When we can't manage what's overwhelming, we go into overload in our nervous system. And we experience what doesn't feel normal. We experience tremendous fear or shutdown or depression or high anxiety. And what has been very useful for folks I work with is to understand the nature of the mind-body trauma, of the reaction to trauma, to understand it. Because people feel guilty who have traumatic responses to things. People feel shame. You know, I shouldn't still be feeling this way, or I should get over it, or it wasn't such a big deal, and minimize what has happened to them. And when people understand how the mind-body responds to overwhelming circumstance, that alone is often very useful in undoing some of the trauma responses. Then there are very specific techniques, like, it's an odd name, something called EMDR. It's a way of working with the brain that has tremendous success in undoing the results of trauma. And another process I use that involves body relaxation called somatic experiencing. There are increasing numbers of very good trauma therapies, and they all in one way or another deal with the sense of overwhelm that has overcome a person who has experienced trauma.
Beth, and of course, you know, dealing with your patients, this certainly is traumatic, what they're going through with you.
Yeah, one of the things that we see in breast cancer care, and, you know, in just about any chronic health illness, health issue, is there's absolutely a factor of what I call post-traumatic stress disorder. It just like what we see within our military and anyone that goes through a very stressful situation. And there is an absolute direct link between our emotional stresses and how our body's immune system responds to them. So a lot of times I see people coming in with a diagnosis of cancer after a horrifically traumatic episode, whether it's a divorce, a loss of a child, some initiating effect, and they say, well, everyone tells me that these two are absolutely not related. And you can't say that a huge stress that beats up your immune system is unrelated to something. It may not have been the only root cause, but it could have been a factor that precipitates it. So to me, just treating the cancer isn't enough. If I don't actually get to the root of what is like the baggage people come into cancer with, then I really can't help them to come out the other side feeling healthy, whole, and complete, getting to a place where they're living not in that fight and flight response where a lot of people live these days.
And Beth, so, I'm sure that relates to you're talking about the cliff. And that the cancer isn't there, the trauma of the cancer is still there. And the trauma for the family is still there. And so important that the whole family system understands what has happened to all of them.
Correct. And it's the, you know, to me, I tell my patients all the time, you know, I would be the best surgeon on the planet if I could skillfully cut out fear when I cut out cancer.
Yeah.
Because fear is that one aspect of cancer that the scalpel cannot take care of.
Yeah.
And it's the one thing that, you know, I learned in my residency, you know, nothing heals like cold steel, to cut is to cure. And I got great technical surgical skills, but I think one of the things that our fellows learn when they come to us is that the surgery part that we do in the operating room is the easiest part of cancer care. The most difficult part is helping our patients navigate through this process to come out the other side feeling whole again, releasing the fear, realizing that, you know, none of us, not any one of us on this conversation today is guaranteed to wake up tomorrow healthy, whole, and complete. You know, we are all living, you know, every day is a gift. And cancer has the ability, if someone chooses, to help to actually get to the other side of whatever it is, like to get to a positive place and really live in the moment and learn how to enjoy life again. And it is a it's kind of been my life's work now is to get, you know, the surgery's the easy part. I swear to God, people laugh at me, but it's like the surgery is the most simple part of what we do. And that's the one thing that if I can impart that wisdom on these young breast surgeons that, you know what you do in the operating room is the easiest thing that you ever do to a patient, because what we really have to do is focus on that individual and how do we get them again to get back to a place where they don't sit in their kitchen waiting for cancer to come back or worried about every ache and pain that they have in their body thinking that it's the cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Beth, your work is a gift, and I'm glad to make your acquaintance over the radio waves. Sorry it's not in person, but it's really lovely hearing how committed you are and passionate about whole health, not just body health.
That's right. The whole person.
I do think it's the wave of the future, though, for healthcare, because I think the whole pill for the ill society and just treating the disease, it doesn't work anymore. We know it. Our healthcare system's broken, and the only way to get back to it is to get back to the basics. Start with how do we get whole again? How do we help people become well?
Well, and thank goodness for Beth Weinstock, you know, who's doing that, you know, helping people get well. Beth, one of the questions I had for you was when you do work with someone and you're working on their inner coach.
Yes.
What is it that you see in speaking to female leadership? What is it that you feel we will see from a cultural standpoint once we're able to get women to move through these insecurities and the negative talk and pursue these leadership roles and take on more responsibility on a global level?
Well, I love that you put that in the future of what we're going to see when.
Yeah. We have a long way to go.
Yeah, but that's
but
the positive.
Okay.
Frame
That's
for
the goal.
It, so
right.
I'm grateful for that. Thank you. I think we're going to see more collaboration, more listening, more support for, quote, balance in life, even though there is no balance in life,
right.
But more attention to validating people's choices, the choice to take time off to be a mother or the choice to not take time off or the choice to have children to not have children. I think that we'll see more permission for bringing children to work where it's appropriate, where there's daycare, where there's more flexibility, where there is both maternity maternity and paternity time off so that infants can experience their parental care. I'd like to see more flexible hours. And I think that women have that understanding because it is the challenge for women to be doing that impossible thing called balance. And we bring that consciousness to work.
Exactly. Definitely. We only have a moment left, so I wanted you to just leave the audience with one last thought. You know, something they can focus on in 2016 to improve their own inner voice.
I love the question. Well, if everyone could think every morning of what encouraging positive message they needed to give themselves during the day, if every day we could name what that was, and every day carry that positive message with us, I think we would make a difference for ourselves and other people.
I think we can that. Right? We can do that, Beth.
Absolutely. I do it. It's
I know you do.
In the mirror, first thing in the morning.
That's right.
Believe me, we all have opportunities for improvement. We just need to focus on what's great about us right now.
That's right. Listen, I am so grateful again, Beth, for you joining us this afternoon. Great conversation.
Thank you. I'm grateful for being here. Thanks, Sue.
And I hope you'll tune in next Monday here at WWDB Talk 860 and WomenToWatch.net and check out our website to see who's in our lineup and who is coming down the road. Beth, I hope you have a great week. Will you be back with us next Monday?
I will be back Monday. I'm teaching a course in Las Vegas this weekend, but I'm coming home Saturday. So I will be here Monday on the show with a smile on my face.
Okay. And again, thank you to Holy Redeemer Health System for being one of our core sponsors. And thank you to Jocelyn Ewart, who's going to be on the air in just a couple of weeks. She's the founding principal of Entrust Financial. That's it, everyone. Thank you so much and have a great week.